This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Again, everyone, and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Dave Wilson. This week, a mobile good food bus for our area, an online auction that raises money for kids' wishes, and on The Good Sentence with Paul McDougall, author and journalist Silver Donald Cameron. That's all coming up on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. You've probably heard of the Children's Wish Foundation, but did you know they have a weekly online auction to help raise funds for the foundation? Kathy Sutherland is the Cape Breton Development Coordinator.
We grant wishes to children living with a life-threatening illness between the ages of 3 and 17, so before their 18th birthday.
So they would contact the Children's Wish Foundation or families or whatever the case may be and say, here's what we're looking for. What are some of the children's wishes from Cape Breton over the years that have been fulfilled?
Oh, a lot. We've done a lot of pools. We've done Disney trips. This week alone, we've booked 2 Disney trips for 2 Cape Breton children. We've done camping trailers. We've done shopping wishes. Some even just simple wishes of going to Halifax for a weekend or a spa weekend with their friends. So it doesn't have to be...
Yeah, it's not always a big, extravagant, costly sort of thing. It can be whatever the person's child wants, right?
Yes.
Tell us about your auction. That's one of the things that a lot of people may not be familiar with. You have an online auction.
We have just started an online auction in December, and it's going amazing. We have been gathering gently used, in very good shape, and new items, and we've been posting them every Sunday. At 5 o'clock, a brand new album goes up. But at 4:30, the album ends from the week before. So the bids usually start at $2, and there's some really great deals that are happening out there.
What kind of items are out there?
We have everything from jewelry to yarn to photos to clothing, children's toys. We've even had cases of diapers that were never opened that people gave us.
They're auctioned on the auction block, I guess you would say.
For the week.
And for the whole week.
Yeah.
You bid on them at the end of the week, the top bidder
wins the auction. So
you could be walking away with something that you got a real deal on.
You do.
How do you take part?
You just join our group. So it's the Children's Wish CB online auction. You can join into the group, and then you can just make your bids there. And then the pickup is at our office. We are located at the Sothang Community Center. We are in the principal's office there on George Street in Sydney.
Okay, you can drop your items off there.
You can drop items off there, and that's where you pick up your items and pay for your items.
Oh, when you buy them.
Yeah, both ways, okay. Drop off and buy.
And all of the money goes towards?
Granting wishes. So since December 15th, we have raised over $7,000 just by people giving items and us posting 20, 25 items a week.
Wow, that's great.
It's amazing.
Yeah. How many volunteers? Any idea how many volunteers are involved in Cape Breton with the Children's Wish Foundation?
We have probably about 30. We have 10 that are extremely active. They almost go to everything. But then we have people who work, so it's hard for them to come to every event.
And how many wishes do you grant per year?
We do on average about 10 to 12, and we're working on 19 right now.
It's called the Cape Breton Good Food Bus, and it will be coming to a community near you in the regional municipality this summer. The bus is the project of a partnership between the United Way, New Dawn Enterprises, and the Ecology Action Center. Jody Nelson is the center's community food coordinator for Cape Breton. Dialogue's Bobby Knox spoke to her.
There's a mobile food market that operates in HRM that was spearheaded by my counterpart in Halifax. And so sort of been watching the project unfold for a few years and, you know, watching all of the successes and all of the interest from the communities. And also since I've started here, I've had people repeatedly ask me why we don't have one.
And what is the whole concept of the bus? Just what is the idea behind it?
Well, basically, it's like affordable, fresh, healthy food on wheels. So it's almost the atmosphere of a farmer's market that comes to you, although not always local products. But the priority in this case, though, is affordability. So we'll be targeting communities that are having barriers to access, whether it's income-related or transportation-related or mobility-related, I suppose.
And do you know what communities you're going to be focusing on at this point? Or
We haven't selected communities yet, but we started the process last night. We hosted an information session in Sydney at the YMCA, and we had a nice turnout. And really, it was just a chance to kind of invite broadly and let everybody know what we're up to. But we're still very interested in hearing from communities that are would like to possibly have a stop in their region. So so what the way that will work is we'll set up meetings with them to sort of work through some of the details and like what would be required on their end, because there is a need for like a community host or a host organization to sort of handle the logistics on their end and to make sure we're meeting the needs of the people in their community and to sort of handle the like the outreach that happens within their community.
So you need to, I guess, somebody in the communities to say, look, the bus is coming and these are the people who might be interested in it, sort of thing.
Yeah. So it requires a lot of support from the host community, because they know what their community needs. They know, you know, what their particular resources are around, you know, putting on a successful market in their location. There's volunteer support required, those sorts of things.
And is the bus going to operate in the just in the regional municipality, or is it Cape Breton wide? Or
this is just a pilot for now, so it is just within CDRM at the moment. But you know, we have big hopes and dreams.
So the hope is to expand beyond the CBRM in future.
Yeah, that would be my hope. I think there's a lot of need across Cape Breton, and there's a lot of rural regions that have challenges in accessing fresh foods. And if we can help that, then that would be my biggest goal, I think.
And the need in Cape Breton, we know there's a high level of child poverty here. I think one in three children living in poverty on the island. Is that what's sort of informing you about the need for this service here in Cape Breton?
Absolutely. You know, in food insecurity, it correlates very directly with poverty rates. And along with that comes, you know, a range of challenges, you know, just trying to fit it in, like to get to a store. But with that, you know, the market, you know, while it is, you know, primarily about providing food, it's also just about community pride, dignity, just having something new and exciting in your community that brings people together. There's a lot of pluses outside of even just accessing the food. And those are some of the, you know, big successes that we've seen in HRM with their project. So it can be a really sort of exciting happening in a community that can really bring people together. And I feel like that kind of positive change has impacts beyond just food access too. So
where are you going to get the food from for the bus? You mentioned you want to make food affordable, and we know fresh produce can be quite expensive sometimes. So where are you going to where are you going to get the food from?
Yeah, so we haven't finalized arrangements with a supplier, but it's in the works. In HRM, they work with Superstore, and they have, you know, a particular arrangement. So basically, it ends up being and the markup is minimal. So it's basically like what you'd expect, you know, kind of like sale prices you'd expect to see on produce at a grocery store. So it's not free, but we make it as affordable as possible, and make it possible for people to access that stuff.
What is the range of food we're talking about here? Is it just fruits and vegetables, or are we looking to go beyond that? Or
I think initially just fruits and vegetables, but we do recognize that, you know, to make coming to the market, you know, sort of effective in someone's like life, their planning in their day. Mm-hmm. I think it would be really great to have more things. And we're working with New Dawn, who has the Better Bite Community Kitchen, and they have, you know, a full kitchen there to make bread or whatever it is that we might want to add. So there's a lot of thoughts about how we can sort of add other elements as we go. You know, the priority is you know, the fresh, healthy food that people have a hard time accessing just at a corner store or whatever. So things like breads or like dry goods would be a nice thing to add. So in HRM, they have added those things, but it happened, you know, further down the road. It didn't happen in their pilot. So we'll see how we're able to introduce those things as we get started.
Is there any plan? Because I know sometimes with fruits and vegetables, and I guess with kids too, it's trying to make these things appealing. Is there any plan to? I guess is there any kind of an education component with this? Recipe suggestions, preparation suggestions that will go along with this.
And there's a lot of room for that kind of element at mm-hmm. the market. So this is where we invite host communities to participate and really sort of add their flavor to their market. So in HRM, you know, we've seen a lot of, you know, dietitians doing sampling or, you know, libraries doing pop-ups at the market or, you know, or just fun elements like, you know, music or face painting. So, and that's really up to the host community, like to add, you know, all of these interesting elements to what their market can be. So we'll be working as much as possible with all the organizations in the communities we visit to really add these other elements.
So some communities make it a real event then?
Yeah, definitely. And last night at the information session, there was a couple people in the crowd were like, well, what about community gardens? You know, maybe they should get involved. And, you know, so, you know, we definitely invite that. If a community garden wanted to come out and have some youth selling some produce alongside the market, perfect, you know, whatever they want to make it.
Okay. So, yeah, so people can customize it to suit their own individual communities.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the bus, I think I was seeing that regional council dealt with that this week. You're getting a bus from the regional municipality, a surplus handy trans bus. Is that correct?
Yeah. So a decommissioned handy trans bus. So we'll retrofit the inside to make it into a movable market, and then we'll be good to go.
So you say you had your first meeting last night. Are there plans for any more meetings, or what's the next step?
From here on in, it'll be personal meetings. So communities that are interested, we'll go to them, and we'll walk through a bunch of the sort of things that they would need to think about to decide whether or not they are prepared to host a market. The couple of versions that we're suggesting right now are throughout our 16-week pilot that starts in August, we would do. Three communities, I think we have room to do three communities biweekly throughout that pilot. And then the alternate weeks, we would do a pop-up market. So for communities that just want to try it out but aren't prepared to commit to a biweekly service, we would do like a pop-up service where we could just go and kind of put on a market event, try it out, you know, see how they feel about it. And, you know, and then as we move beyond a pilot, you know, maybe they'd be prepared for something more regular. But, yeah, those are the couple of versions that we've sort of offered up.
And if someone is hearing this and is interested, is there still time if people would like to contact you to, you know, to get involved?
Absolutely, yeah. It's not like if you didn't make it to the information session, it's not like you're off the list. We really want people to hear about it. We want to make sure we're kind of stepping outside of our regular circle of contacts, I guess you'd say. So, yeah, so please do reach out, and I would be the person to contact. So my email address is jody@ecologyaction.ca, so jody@ecologyaction.ca.
This week on The Good Sentence with Paul McDougall, a conversation with author and journalist Silver Donald Cameron.
Well, it goes back to when I was a columnist for the Halifax Sunday Herald, and I thought we were doing really interesting things. People who were helping to solve the problems that we've created for ourselves in this small and suffering planet. And I thought, wouldn't it be great to have a long talk with them at some point? And so I thought, you know, an hour or something like that, but to be able to really dig into what they're thinking and what they're saying. So that was kind of the genesis of it. And over the last 10 years, we've done more than 100 interviews, and some of them are with, you know, really towering figures: Paul Watson, Jane Goodall, James Lovelock, David Suzuki, and so on. Many of them are with much less known people. I mean, one favorite who used to be a racing car driver in England and wanted to end the damage that's done by personal transportation to the environment, so set out to reinvent the automobile and also the automobile industry, and now produces a small urban car that runs on hydrogen power, has zero emissions. Not many people know anything about him, but he's now actually selling these cars commercially in South Wales, and you know, so we had an hour with him explaining just how this all came about and also how it works. So we've had a wonderful time over the last 10 years, interviewed the Prime Minister of Bhutan, where they're pursuing gross national happiness instead of gross national product. It's been a great education, everything else aside.
Gross national happiness. How does Bhutan measure that?
Good question and a very interesting answer. It's measured by a guy. The measurements were devised by a guy named Ron Coleman, who had been working on the Genuine Progress Index for Nova Scotia and was based in St. Margaret's Bay. And basically, they established, I think, 9 domains, and each of those 9 domains had something like a dozen variables. And there are things like family stability, forest cover over the country, which is a measure of the health of the ecology around it, the level of education, level of health, and interestingly enough, they show that this place, the east coast of Canada, is the happiest part of the country, even though it shows up at the bottom of the gross domestic product numbers. But gross happiness, this is a place where, you know, families are stable, people own their own homes, the air is good, you know, there's a whole range of stuff. Right?
That was one of at least 100 interviews that you have now on your website. You've just recently done 4 new ones in Halifax. So tell us about the people that are involved getting these interviews together beyond yourself.
Small team. The core of it is me and Chris Beckett. Chris is a CBC news and current affairs producer for most of his life. Spent the last part of his life as the producer of educational television at Mount St. Vincent University. So Chris, we like to say, does all the work behind the scenes, behind the camera. He does the shooting, he does the editing, all of that technical stuff. Then when the interviews are done, they're transcribed, and we have a person who does that on a sort of piecework basis. So we present them in audio and video and text. And we have a researcher and editor, Linda Pinozzo, who then massages them into publishable form and who also does a lot of the pre-research for the interviews themselves. And then a little team in Sydney who actually put them up on the website.
So this isn't something that you just do on the weekend on a whim then?
certainly not on a whim. It's planned out fairly well in advance, you know. But at the time, we have no real money, and we don't want to have a large carbon footprint. We try to cluster the interviews. I mean, the reason we did four in Halifax was there was a conference there called Beyond GDP, so on other measures of progress like gross national happiness or genuine progress index, that sort of thing. And so we got four interviews. One of them was John Helliwell, edits the UN World Happiness Report. One of them was with Julia Kim from Bhutan, who runs the National Center in Thimphu, Bhutan. One of them was, I'm just trying to think who the other, Catherine Trebek, who's with the Wellbeing Economy Group in Scotland. And one was Mark Anielski, who's written a book called The Economics of Happiness and runs a consulting firm in Edmonton.
So how much background work do you think, on average, you put in, like, for every interview? You've got to read stuff they've done or watch things they've said or whatever.
Yeah.
You yourself, as the interviewer, you got to come up with all the questions and how you want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm about to do one with Margaret Atwood, and I've been reading her books and looking at the websites and seeing talks that she's done and other interviews with her for two or three weeks. And, I would say every one of them is at least a day, probably 2 days' work, just in preparation, maybe more than that, scattered over a period of time, you know.
Of the 100 interviews or so, is there one? I'm not going to make you pick out your favorite interviewer. Something like that. But is there an interview with all these people? And as you said, some of these are very prominent names in Canada and internationally, and others like Hugo, you mentioned with the car, is a lot many people don't know about. But of these interviews, is there one of them or one or two of them that something in the interview really surprised you, that it might have went a different way, you know, or there was something about it that you didn't expect and it was like a wow moment, anything like that?
I think that happens fairly often, to be truthful, because, you know, these are people who've been doing whatever it is that they do for a long time, and there's all kinds of... one example is David Suzuki in the middle of the interview saying that the First Nations have been his teachers for over 40 years. Well, I don't think many people know that about David, his daughter is married into the Haida First Nation in British Columbia. He has a grandson who is First Nations child. So a bunch of those things. The sort of thing that always pleases me is we're interviewing Yvonne Chouinard, who is the owner and developer of Patagonia Sportswear. This is a company he owns completely, and it's oriented towards the environment very strongly. He's been instrumental in really changing the way clothing is made. So we were talking with him, and a very interesting guy. Partway through the interview, he said, "You boys have really done your homework." Because, I mean, I love to be able to come up with something that the person doesn't expect me to know. And I think the secret of a great interview, to a large extent, is preparation, so that you do know those things.
Okay, so then if I said, tell us about Stella Boyles, what would you say to that?
I would say Stella is this remarkable teenager from the Lahave River here in Nova Scotia who learned more or less by accident that the river was badly polluted and found out that there were over 600 houses just dumping their sewage straight out of a straight pipe into the river. So when she found that, she said, well, there ought to be regulations about that. And she's only 13 at this point. And her parents said, yes, there are. And she said, well, then why is it happening? And they said, well, the regulations aren't enforced. Well, why are they not enforced? Well, because there's no real pressure on, the authorities to do that. In the meantime, she's learning from a retired scientist next door to do the testing of the river and to determine just exactly how polluted it is. And the answer is horribly polluted. By the time you get to the age of 16, she has, raised the alarm about this to the point where they've raised, the governments have committed themselves, the three levels of government have committed to $16.7 million to clean up the river. She has been, on Canada's Walk of Fame. She's lecturing in Sweden, doing all kinds of stuff. And I look at this and I think to myself, how many people have I met that say, these problems are so big, what can one person do? I can't do anything. Well, here's a 13-year-old, and you damn well can do something.
I listened to the interview a couple of nights ago. I didn't know anything about her, but I thought this is a good one because my background teaching public health at CBU was microbiology. So I'm interested in, what did she actually do? And then you get her to actually explain the tests. And she's there she's a little older now, but she was like 11 and 12 doing fecal enterococci tests, which is exactly the test that you would do. And then she was testing bioindicator organisms that go up and down, pollution there. And I'm thinking, like, you know, most people, these terms don't even, you know, enterococci doesn't even ever enter your mouth as a word, let alone in the water, right?
So it enters, like, you, though.
But it enters us, and we yeah. carry it, and that's what comes out, and that's what's polluting the river. It's just like, she was dead on with everything she did there. It's just like, the term is citizen science. You used that in your interview a number of times with her, and she's like the perfect example, but she's so young doing it.
Well, you know, she doesn't know what can't be done. Parents who are very supportive and very open, they don't say, there, just go to sleep now. They, you know, they support her. They actually help her to get the sign created. And then she has a neighbor who's a retired biologist who instructs her in how to do the work and walks her through it, how it's done, and starts to do it. And then the other thing I missed out was that she not only does the sign, she does a Facebook page. And that really gets the word out, too. But her view now is that her next role is to teach other kids on other rivers in Nova mm-hmm. Scotia how to do the same work and to try and clean up all the rivers in Nova Scotia.
Yeah, and plus there's a book came out about it. Her neighbor yeah. is a writer, and she's done a book that came out just last year, 2018, about the whole thing. Yep. It's really a fascinating story.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. And she's a charming young woman. That's she's not just a remarkable young woman, but she's athletic. She's just a great young woman.
Listening to her talk, it's like you don't realize she's so young. She sounds like someone in her 20s and that's been doing this kind of work all the time.
Yes, she
yeah,
does.
And her goal is to be an environmental lawyer.
Yes, yes. Which brings us, if you want, to the Green Rights Project.
Exactly. So why don't we talk about that in your book we're written about it?
Yeah, well, that comes out of... Chris and I had been doing these interviews for, I don't know, up until 2012, so 3 or 4 years. And then we interviewed a guy who was visiting Halifax named David Boyd. And David had just written a book called The Environmental Rights Revolution. He's a lawyer. He was with Sierra Legal Defense, now Eco Justice. But he had basically looked at the fact that the human right to a healthy environment was first discussed in 1972 in Stockholm at the Stockholm Conference, which was organized by a Canadian, by the way. And that right has now been adopted by most of the nations in the world. Out of the 193 nations in the UN, 177, one way or another, recognized that their citizens had a right to a healthy environment and had a right to take legal action if the environment was damaged. So a right to clean air, a right to healthy food, a right to clean water. And so that meant that we're, for example, downstream from Northern Pulp, and that if we had those rights, you would be able to sue Northern Pulp on your own initiative. As it stands now, all we can do as Nova Scotians is plead with the provincial government to plead with Northern Pulp, but we can't actually take action on our own behalf because of their insults to the environment. Well, around the world, as I say, most countries have that. The 16 that don't include Canada and the United States and Oman and North Korea, and in fairness, Australia, Japan, and China. But most of the countries do have that. So when we discovered that, we said, well, David, tell us some stories about this. How is this used? So he tells us about a wonderful lawyer in the Philippines, Antonio Oposa Jr., who established that there was a legal right of future generations to inherit a healthy environment from us. He talks about the Netherlands, where a lawyer named Roger Cox and a wonderful organization called the Urgenda Foundation sued the Netherlands government for keep their commitments on climate change and won the appeal. He talks about the cleanup of the Riachuelo River in Argentina, where a lawyer named Daniel Salaberry and a group of riverside slum dwellers sued 3 levels of government and 44 corporations to clean up the open sewer that was the river that ran by their doors and won. And that is a spectacular victory. So we start to hear these stories about wonderful things that people have been able to do with environmental rights when they had them. So we set out to do that, and we wound up doing 30 interviews from people in, I think, 11 countries, putting that material together and making a 67-minute feature documentary out of it and a 45-minute television special that the CBC broadcast and a book called Warrior Lawyers. And that's the basis for the course that I've been teaching at CBU.
Yeah, let's... Let's segue into that course then now. Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about this. You've got basically one year of this. You've done the first year of it, right?
We have.
Yeah.
And
tell us about it and how it went.
Well, I think it went wonderfully well, and happily most of my students think so too. But basically we took that same material and said, okay, we can make a university course basically out of studying the human right to a healthy environment, where it exists, where it doesn't exist, what happens when it's invoked and so forth. And happily, one of the people I'd met in the course of my promotion of this was a law professor named Stephen Wood, who was then at Osgoode Hall in Toronto and is now at UBC. And so when I talked about doing a course, Stephen said, well, can we do it? Why can't we do it together? And so we wound up doing this, I think, absolutely unique course. We would meet every week for 2.5 hours. The first hour and a half, I would introduce people to one of these stories, the one from Ecuador, let's say, or the one from, it doesn't matter, all kinds of them, give the legal perspective on it and speak with the students. And then at the end of the hour and a half, he would go away with his students. We'd basically break the connection. And I would talk to my own students in political science course at CBU. He would talk to students in law course at UBC. And the part that we'd done together, which had been basically broadcast over the web, constituted two other courses from CBU. One of them was a curiosity version of the course, so people were allowed to sit in and just listen if they were curious about it. And one of them was a certificate course, so you could get a certificate at the end of the course that's certified that you had attended and done the required work, which wasn't terribly heavy, but and that turns out to be useful for people like lawyers, for example, who have to do continuing legal education. Actually, we had students in the certificate program who were faculty members at least four institutions of higher education. So, and the reviews, if you will, have been really quite splendid.
So those are two C's, and the third C is actually a credit.
It's the actual credit course in the classroom, Political Science 3705. That in itself is what we call a synchromodal course.
So you've got people in the classroom, literally. You're in the classroom with them.
I'm in the classroom with six people.
At the CBU campus, yep. And your partner's got a group as well.
Yep, he's got a dozen or so in Vancouver.
And then there's an online component that's happening at the same time.
People have tuned into
people
that.
People have tuned in.
Yep.
So where I'm going then is that the technology there, this had to be all pretty well coordinated, right? And getting people to come to the class and all this. So how did all that go?
It was new for a lot of us. But by the time we'd been through, two or three sessions of it, it was running pretty smoothly. By the end, it was fine. I tell you one thing that was really odd that never occurred to me beforehand was on two occasions we were snowed out at CBU. The campus was closed. So what I wound up doing in that case in the normal way, then that class was available for my students to see. And then we had a meeting with my own students to discuss what had been broadcast there.
Fascinating. What's the name of this course again? What are we calling it?
It's called Green Rights, the Human Right to a Healthy World.
Okay. Is it going to go again, is it in September or January term?
We're intending to do it in September again, but it took some resources and it made some demands on the university system that I think the university is a little uncomfortable with, so we'll probably be doing it in a slightly different form, recording it and then broadcasting the recording or something like that. Mm-hmm. But if people are interested in looking into it,
You've got a website, right? So
that's actually an email.
Yeah, I'm just going to give this to people in case folks out there are interested. It's learning@thegreeninterview.com. So if you're interested in this course, it's it doesn't hurt to send an email and find out some more about it.
Yeah, and I will be collecting those emails and letting people know what's happening, just keeping people abreast as it develops. But we should be going live with it in early September.
Fantastic. So now another piece of news for you is that you've recently been appointed the Farley Mowat Chair in Environment at CBU. You're the first appointment to this.
Well, it is brand new, and I'm brand new to it, but it's got to be the most wonderful gig you could possibly have because it really carries very few responsibilities. So the appointment letter says wants me to be engaged with sustainability in all its various forms at CBU, and of course it's quite a major theme at CBU. This is the only university in the country, for example, that provides its own power from renewable energy, has its own wind farm on Grand Lake Road. So kind of getting together with and doing things together with various people on the campus who have an interest in this. Teaching the course isn't required, but obviously is closely connected with that. Like the Green Rights Project, I hope there are going to be other projects that will involve, in fact, we're actually working on one now, which is called Counting What Counts, the idea that the gross domestic product measures everything except what makes life worth living, as Bobby Kennedy said. So are there better ways of measuring progress? Yes, there are. Gross National Happiness, Genuine Progress Index, etc. So I'd like to do another whole project that has interviews and probably a book and probably documentary films and so forth with that. And I'll do that while I'm, to some extent, the appointment letter simply says, go on doing what you do, but do it here. Yeah. Which is pretty lovely.
Under
you know?
The auspices of the university.
Yeah.
Which does things like that.
Absolutely.
It's kind of a come around for you, right? Because you were dean, they call it the School of Community Studies?
Yep.
Back, was it in the 70s?
90s.
It was in the 90s.
Yeah, 94 to 97.
Yeah, I'm not going to put you back too far.
Well, I go back.
you go back.
I've got to tell you, I don't know of anybody who has a relationship with the university comparable to my relationship with CBU. I spoke to the graduating class in I think, maybe 1976, when it was the College of Cape Breton. I became writer-in-residence from 78 to 80, when it was still the College of Cape Breton. Came back in 94 to be dean and professor of problem-centered studies and enjoyed that very much. But during the course of that, my wife died and Franz established a scholarship in her name at CBU. My archives are at the Beaton Institute of Cape Breton Studies. My professional library is in the library at CBU. And now I'm back as the Farley Mowat. Oh, and I have an honorary degree from CBU as well. So who else has that kind of, you know, intense relationship over 4 decades with the university?
Yeah, it's really terrific. I'd like to talk a little bit about Mowat. I mean, you are the Farley Mowat Chair. It's named after him, and we all know what a considerable force he was for decades in Canadian literature, and he was a character in and of himself, and you've written about him, and you talk about Farley, if you know him in the publishing world, and Farley, if you knew him in the private world, and Farley, if you knew him just from his books or writing and didn't know anything else about him. And Farley did have a summer place down around where you live. But there's a phrase you use about Farley in one of your things you wrote about him. You said he was the master of a term you called the Mowat. And it's, you said a Mowat, it's not exactly fiction, but it's not exactly fact. Why don't we just talk a little bit about Farley Mowat, because you have a more than casual relationship with him, and now you're the chair, so you're taking on his name in some ways, right? Mm. So tell us a little bit about the Mowat, mm. the literary style that he wrote.
Well, honored to be associated with him, too. I mean, but we were friends for years, 40, 45 years, and I miss him terribly. His wife, incidentally, will be at the ceremony when I'm inaugurated in the chair. Yeah, Claire.
Yeah.
All else aside, he was probably the first major Canadian environmentalist. I mean, if you go back to his early books, People of the Deer and Never Cry Wolf, all of those books, he was basically blowing the whistle about what we're doing to the environment. Back in the 70s, when hardly anybody else, he was almost right on the heels of earlier than that, actually. He was back with Rachel Carson,
yeah.
You know? So one of the real founders of the environmental movement. And
I think he was doing it, and people didn't know he was doing it until almost, right?
Yes. And that's where his, basically he was such a great storyteller that you got engaged with the story, and only later did you realize that your idea of what a wolf was all about was completely changed after you'd read Never Cry Wolf. You know, your idea of what was going on in the North was completely changed after you've read People of the Deer and realized how close to nature these folks were and what damage we were doing to them as well as to the environment they relied on. So, I think he was a towering figure. figure, and a writer for sure. He's the I think by far the best-selling author that Canada's ever produced. Books all over the world, over 40 books, and I used to say to him sometimes, he'd say, "Well, that's it. This is my last book. I've just published my last book." And I'd say, "Okay," and he'd go home to Ontario for the winter. They were generally here from May to October or something like that, so a good portion of the year. And then he'd come back the next year, and he'd say, "Well, the new book is coming along well." And I'd say, "Wait a minute, Farley. Last year it was your last." "Oh, yeah, but I had this idea," he says. And then finally he said, "I don't know how you'd quit." He said, "You know, what I've been doing all my life is I get up and I go to my desk and I go to work on a new book. And if I stopped doing that, what would I do? I don't golf, you know." Yeah, so he was a real inspiration.
Yeah. Sea of Slaughter is one that comes to mind to me. I remember reading that when that first came out, and you know, just the name alone, you know what it's all about. It was just like some of the things and the way he described, and he gets into the history of the fisheries, you know, going way back and then up into the, you know, present day and the cod and all. Like he really did his work. He did his research on it all.
He absolutely did, and I think that's actually his masterpiece. It is a bleak masterpiece. It makes you confront what we've done to the West Atlantic, and it's not a pretty story, but it's the truth, you know, and it's a story. It's a truth we need to hear about. And you're right; it was based on, you know, a couple of four or five years of research and writing, I think. It took him a long time to do it, and partly because he kept, in a sense, sort of shrinking from the skin, not wanting to find out about what actually happened to the very last great auk that there will ever be. Did find out about it, told it movingly in the book. It's related to some of his other books, like A Whale for the Killing, for example, which is the story of the death of a single whale in the south coast of Newfoundland. Yeah. I think it's a magnificent piece of work.
Yeah. And then Whale for the Killing, I mean, they were living there at the time, and after that came out, he basically was time to move on, right? It was like some...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, some people didn't want that stuff there, right?
Well, and you know, Farley was interesting on that subject, because he said that, you know, the story came out, and basically it was a whale on off the ocean and couldn't get out again. Only got in sort of by a fluke at high tide, and a bunch of local yahoos driving around firing weapons at it, and ultimately, you know, it died of, I think, blood poisoning from all the lead that was in it. Why you would do that is beyond me, but they did. And as Farley said, it was only a handful of people that did that. Most of the people there were quite sympathetic to the whale's plight, and Farley and others were working to try and get it back out to sea and weren't able to do that. And then the whale died, but by that point Farley had told enough about it that the world was watching that whale. And when the whale died, the rest of Bergio, and then Bergio thought, well, Mowat is the guy who made this whole thing so public, and turned on Farley.
Unfortunately, because it certainly wasn't the whole little town of Virgil.
He loved that place, yeah. And he loved those people.
That's why he was there.
Yeah, yeah,
he
absolutely.
He didn't live in places he didn't like.
No, and he liked to live in places that were, you know, close to the natural world and more close to the sort of fundamentals of humanity. So, yeah, it was terribly hurtful that he didn't, they felt they had to leave.
It part of that story that has always kind of stuck with me, and you can still think about it, is that he went there to ever witness something like that. I mean, Farley Mowat was he was a war veteran, right? That's the last thing he probably ever would have thought was going to happen down in that little...
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
So it must have been...
Well, and, you know, and part of the reason that he went back into the natural world and became a biologist and did the work that he did was because he had lived through the war. I mean, he went overseas. He was, what, 18, 20? I mean, very young man, as most of them were.
Yeah.
And then fought all the way up through the Italian campaign and he said, "This is the only... We are the only animal that would bring down the whole world in senseless slaughter." And he was not a big fan of human beings by the end of the war. And that's what drove him out to talk to people in the north, talk to First Nations, talk to fishing communities. Recognized, of course, that you know, that everything does some killing in order to live, and that, you know, wrote quite a positive book about sealing, the great seal hunt, and mm-hmm. all of that, you know.
In your book, Sterling Silver, which is... came out in 1994. I see it's just being reissued, 25th anniversary.
Yeah.
So congratulations on that, which is nice. But you, one of your interviews was with Farley.
Yes.
And a story was about Farley, and he. This is the quote, sort of fitting what we're just saying here. Nobody who watches can possibly doubt it, he concludes. We're going to destroy ourselves and our environment, and the world will be better for our going. I'm going to say, I hope this doesn't come true, but where do you think it is with all your work and what you're doing? Are we going to, is the world going to prove that quote by Farley wrong?
Well, I hope it is, and I comfort myself with a couple of things. One of them is that I know I'm not a very good prophet, and so although it doesn't look good, I'm the guy that said there would never be a bridge to Prince Edward Island. But the more important thing, I think, is there's an interview in the book that came out of the Green Rights Project, Warrior Lawyers. There's an interview there with Cormac Cullen, and Cormac is a lawyer in South Africa who's written a wonderful book called Wild Law about trying to make our legal system harmonize with the world around us. Well, Cormac lived through the end of apartheid. And when he talks about apartheid, he uses the analogy of apartheid to talk about the natural world and what's happening to it. And he said, you know, all kinds of people worked against apartheid for years, decades, and in many cases died before apartheid collapsed, right? But worked in the faith that it would collapse. And I think that idea of getting rid of the ends, of not thinking that I'm doing this because I expect the world to turn around just because I'm working at this, but saying, you know, win or lose, this is the way I want to live my life. This is the way I feel comfortable with myself and my conscience. And I think you do it in that way, and all you can do is hope for the best. I mean, if you don't do it, you know, it's certainly not going to happen. If you do do it, it may or may not happen, but at least it won't have failed because you didn't do your part.
That's right. So this, the Green, the interviews, the you have a passion for it, and you... You don't seem to be in any way slowing down what you're doing. And you've been writing, like, you have 17 books? Am I right?
I think it's the 19th one, okay. That's in the press now.
Well,
yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, the 19th book, is the one that's in the press now, has the working title Midnight Slider. It's about Philip Boudreau, the poacher who was killed in Richmond County in 2013.
Okay.
By three very reputable fishermen. And this, how the question around the island, Almadam, where I live, was how did this happen? And how could these guys have been responsible for an act like that? And that's really what the book sets out to answer, is to say what really happened here. Because by no means all of the story came out in court. So I've spent a lot of time talking to, I've lived there since almost 50 years. And so all of that time there and the people I know there and a lot of conversations that aren't on the record and so forth have all gone into this book.
When did you think that you would do that story? I mean, being so close to it, you could see maybe a writer from Halifax area thinking, well, there's a book in here, I can come down, talk to people, and then go. Mm. But like you said, these are your people. Did you hesitate, or what made you think that I should do this?
I absolutely did hesitate, and I hesitated very seriously when I was well into it. And I found myself in a community where I was just, people reacted as I thought people should react, and, you know, interacted as I thought they should interact. So that's kind of the background. But when I came back in 2015, I was spending the winter in BC, and I came back to do a couple of weeks of interviewing and research, and so I talked to a number of people around the community, and didn't talk to a number of people who said we should not be talking about this. This is over. It's done. Bury it. Let it go. And I took that pretty seriously. I mean, these are people I respect, and I don't want them hurt, and I don't want them. You know, I don't want them feeling invaded or offended or anything like that. One of the people I talked to was Edgar Sampson. And Edgar runs the Premium Seafoods plant there. He's one of the major employers on the island, a very gifted entrepreneur and a very fine man. And so I interviewed him. And then on the way back to BC, I was in the airport, and there was Edgar in the lounge. And he said, how did it go? And I said, well, you know, Edgar, I'm really wondering whether I should proceed, because I've had enough people say, let it go and leave it alone and all of that sort of thing, and that it really shakes me up. And I don't want to write a book here that will be damaging, you know? And so what do you think? And Edgar, bless his heart, took it very seriously. It took a very long moment and looked out the window at the air at the tarmac, and you see, he turned it all around, and then he said, "I think you should do it." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Yeah, I think it'll help the island to heal, and you'll do it fairly and well." And I thought to myself, that's quite a compliment from a longtime neighbor. And that was really the moment where I thought, okay, a people and the island to heal.
Yeah. The Midnight Slider?
Midnight Slider, yeah.
Yeah, soon to be out then.
Next March.
Next March, okay. Yeah. Going through edit and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. The book is, the manuscript is finished, but the editor is just going through.
Yeah.
And of course, when you take the story like that to Toronto, the Toronto editor sort of says, you should say more about this and less about that and so on. So I'll be giving a significant rewrite. But,
yeah.
But it's done. It'll be out.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Paul.
And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly. Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.